It is good to be back with you this morning and to be back with you in the capacity of teaching a Bible class. I feel like I've not been up in the pulpit near enough lately, and we were not able to study from this particular book last week, so I thought since we had just begun a new scene, which is the 11th scene in our notes, referencing the beast which arose from the earth in Revelation chapter 13. Beginning in verse 11, that I would do just a very quick and concise review of what we have discussed so far on this before we get into new material. And so I want to note, first of all, that the very previous scene or previous vision of John's in Revelation chapter 13, verses 1 through 10, we noted the rise of the beast from the sea that we identified as being a world power, the secular power that would and did oppress the people of God, that it was granted to him, notice verse 7, to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him. So a very powerful enemy of the cross in this beast from the sea. And again, it is somewhat dependent upon the time in which you think the book of Revelation was written as to what power you would attribute this to. And as we have been taking as our premise in this study, the latter writing of the date, then we would ascribe this to the Roman Empire. The second section of our study that we began in our last study begins in verse 11, going down through verse 18, has reference to a companion beast, this one arising from the earth. Now, I'd like you to read with me, beginning verse 11, I'll read through it very quickly to verse 18, since it's a fairly short narrative. John said, "I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, spoke like a dragon, and he exercises all of the authority of the first beast in his presence, and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs, so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. He deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark of the name of the beast or the number of his name. And here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man." His number is 666. This is, again, a fairly well-known passage of Scripture, especially when you talk about the mark of the beast as being the number 666. We're all very familiar with that, primarily because of the error that has propagated surrounding these words in the religious world today. Just make a quick note about that. Premillennialism is an appealing, in some ways, false position, sophistry. It's not truth, but it appeals to the imaginations of men because it takes literally the images that we see in the book of Revelation. And you no doubt have heard individuals seek to speculate on what the mark of the beast really is. And depending upon what premillennialist teacher you may hear, it will go from the social security numbers that we all have one of the most recent ones. I'll actually give you two examples of recent ones. One is the idea of having a capsule put under your skin so that you can utilize it for identification purposes. I mean, we've done that with pets, but children, some children have had that done. Experimental individuals have put those kinds of things under their skin, and there had been an idea out that that would be a mark of the beast. And the one that is absolutely the latest has reference to vaccination cards. And the idea that in order to do commerce in our nation because of the pandemic, it's going to be necessary for you to have proof that you have been immunized. And if you've not been immunized, you're not going to be allowed to get on planes. You're not going to be allowed to do commerce, to buy and to sell, which would have a direct impact on these things. So some people actually are advocating that this new call for a vaccination passport, that would be a sign of the beast or a mark of the beast. There have been many others that have been postulated down through the ages. And we'll talk a little bit about that a little bit later. But I want to kind of set aside all those false positions and views and make note of a couple of foundational things that are found in this text. First of all, that the beast which arises from the earth supports that secular power, that beast from the sea that has authority over men. Secondly, and we made allusion to this in our discussion, introductory thoughts 2 weeks ago, the beast from the sea is identified differently in three other passages of Scripture. It has reference to the same being or personage that is found here in verses 11 through 18. It's identified in chapter 16 and 19 as well as chapter 20 as being the false prophet. So notice, and if you'd like those verses, it's chapter 16 and verse 13. In the pouring out of the sixth bowl of wrath, it says that it was out of the mouth of the beast, out of the mouth of the false prophet, out of the mouth of the dragon, the unclean spirits would arise. The defeat of both beasts is stated in chapter 19 and verse 20. Those two, having reference to the beast and to the false prophet, would be cast in the lake of fire and brimstone. And then in chapter 20, with regard to the defeat of the dragon himself or Satan, it is stated that he would join the beast and the false prophet in that lake of fire. So those three references of the false prophet are references to this beast which arose from the earth. So with that in mind, you may remember that we noted a couple of things to introduce when we start each section. For those who are visiting with us, we kind of in that first reading give some impressions. And what I wanted to present to you is this idea of the formidable nature of these opponents of Christians in the first century. Not only did you have the authority, secular authority, the Roman Empire, which oppressed and persecuted Christians even to death, but you had this second beast who supported the first. And the second beast being religion, you'll note that the second beast would erect the image of the first beast, that he would perform signs and cause men. I want you to notice especially that statement that is given there. Let's see. Verse 12. He exercised all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast. So he contributes to the cause of evil by, in this way, seducing those of the world to offer up their allegiance, but also their worship to the Roman Empire, or to in the person of the Roman Emperor. And emperor worship was something that was present late in the first century. Domitian, as emperor, for example, at the time of John's writing, was one who declared himself to be a god, and it was required in the Roman Empire that all subjects of the emperor to bow down and to worship him. Something very similar to what we saw with Nebuchadnezzar, for example, is found in the book of Daniel. And so this is something that was practiced, and so we see how these two things tie together. And so it is a very formidable, a very intimidating partnership that we find here that did a great deal of destructive, was very destructive, desperate to the people of God here in this time. So when you think about that, you think about the ability to perform these signs that are mentioned in verses 11 and 16. We consider the ostracization of the people of God. This is something that is full of foreboding. But I do want you to note, and we'll talk about this a bit more later, but if you'll notice in verse 18 of the text, as there have been allusions to the ultimate defeat of these opponents, so it is in verse 18 of the text. Now, just jump back to verse 11 for a second. This is the first beast, you'll notice. that he is going to lead individuals into captivity, he's going to kill by the sword. But we are told he who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. And this is the patience and the faith of the saints. So that indicates that while this is indeed a dire circumstance, these are formidable opponents, ultimately, that God and his people win out. Because the one who is doing this, the one who is oppressing the people of God, he will one day suffer the consequence of that. And of course, we read again in chapter 19 and verse 20 that that first beast was cast in the lake of fire and brimstone. If you'll notice in verse 18, it's perhaps a bit more subtle, but the same thing is said with regard to the second beast. So the second beast, the number of his name, that he is going to put that mark upon all, and they will worship him. Here is wisdom. Now I want you to notice the parallel to the statement, here is the patience and faith of the saints in verse 11, with this statement, here is wisdom. So this is something that John and Jehovah in this vision wants the children of God to understand. When you think about this, when you consider this, if you are discerning, if you are wise, what you will recognize and understand is that the mark of the beast is the mark of a man. And so that is contrasted with God, who is divine. So we have the divine number, the number of perfection, the number of completeness is the number 7. The number of a man is one less than that. Man is incomplete. Man is imperfect. Man is human. And this is an indication in the number 666. People often do not grasp this when they think about the foreboding nature of that number and how it is a mark of the beast and such. That mark is an indication of the ultimate failure of the beast from the earth. Because his number is not the number of God, it's the number of man. And just as man ultimately, if man presents himself against God, is destined to fail because God is sovereign, God is preeminent, God is omnipotent. Fact is that these beasts that ally themselves against God, Satan himself, and we alluded to that in the previous chapter, who knew that he has only a little time, which is why he brings his fierceness upon the earth after he was cast out of heaven, ultimately they are defeated. And so while we have fear and foreboding, as we consider all of what can be done to the disciples here in the first century, and in like manner what can befall us as we live on this earth, fact is, we can have confidence and ultimately joy in the realization that all of the efforts to destroy God and his people will be found lacking, and God will ultimately be in control. So that's kind of the overview of that section that we wanted to make note of. Anybody have any... yes, Dick, go ahead.
It's right up there in chapter 13, where Satan tried and he's defeated.
That's exactly right. And I think that's what's been borne out in these couple of chapters that we've read. Satan does not want for effort. I think that Satan recognized in his defeat in heaven as he came down to earth that he was finished. But we are told that as a result of being cast down to earth, then he puts his attention upon mankind, and especially those of the cross, in order to destroy them or to do as much damage as he possibly can. But that ultimately he'll be defeated. He knows he's defeated. And I think as was read, and that, I like that as very plain commentary there. 666 is close, but it's not good enough, and it doesn't reach up to 777, and as such, the failure of the devil is set, and it's obvious, and there is some significance in that number, not just the foreboding of the number, ooh, who has the mark, but that mark is indicative of failure, ultimate failure, because it falls short of God. All right, anybody else? Yes, Dennis.
My best takeaway from this last verse here is that Jesus and John is talking to people who are well dead. This was written for someone who understood what the verse was saying to them. Whatever we say this 666 is, we don't. We are speculating either way. Whatever we say,
right.
It's just pure speculation.
Certainly.
But they knew. So when it was said to them, when John wrote, "Here's wisdom, let him who has understanding," those Christians had the understanding to understand, to know what he was saying, but also to calculate what this number meant. If we make it just a name, there's no calculation necessary. And that's what we do when we just say it's not God. It's something other than God. If it's just one less than God, then 6 should suffice. We've never seen 777 used for God so far in the letter, and we won't again.
No, it's not.
Well, now we're making it stand for God, because it has to, if we make 666 be less than God. If it's just less than God, then why not? You know, 776. So what we're doing is we establish a view, and then we support that view by the way we interpret the verse. And all I'm saying is that we can't know, we can't say one way or the other what it is, as far as our interpretations. The most that we can say is that they knew what it was and what it was talking about. My thinking is, if it's a calculation, and it's the number of a man, then it's identifying a specific man. But we're saying it's just man in general.
I don't know that. I mean, it's not my intent to say man in general. My only intent in this particular section, as far as what my explanation would be, to indicate that concept that it is. An indication of the defeat, the imminent defeat or the ultimate defeat, despite this show of power that we find in the 11th chapter. The significance of the numbers, we've talked about that and the symbology of it. I would take issue with the idea that there is ultimately any calculation involved. I think that they could identify what the mark was. In other words, they have knowledge. They had knowledge in the first century that we do not fully in agreement with you. But if I'm being consistent with the way I've approached the Book of Revelation in these things, that the numbers are symbolic numbers, that there's no calculation needed in the number 666 as to what it is or who it is or the reference. It's simply that they would be able to recognize who it was and recognize what was required, for example, with regard to the doing of commerce and why they were excluded, what differed between them and between the ones who had the mark on their forehead or on their hands, and make that distinction. Because I don't think that the number 666, it is the mark of the beast, but it's not the identification of the beast. I don't see that in that particular text. I see that is the way in which the beast marks. In other words, it's the mark that belongs to the beast, the way he identifies who is his on the earth. And I don't know what that mark would be. I'm with you with regard to that. But if I take the idea, you know, we've looked at the 144,000, we've looked at the 12 elders, the 24 elders, the four living creatures, and we've seen all of those kinds of numbers, and we can kind of come up with ideas, but the general concept of the number 12 and then doubled if we want to make a computation, you know, all we can say is okay, the apostles and the patriarchs. But I don't know if that's exactly what's under consideration in that either. But what I get from that is the trebling of the number. It would be like the 144,000. It's 12 by 12 by 1,000, or 10 by 10 by 10. So as far as trying to look and see, identify as to who it was, I'm not necessarily even sure that the beast in this particular text is an individual at all. Could be more representative of the religion in general that supported the emperor worship, or that brought about the emperor worship, rather than a single individual.
I guess the main point I'm trying to make, maybe I'm not doing it here as well, I'm not arguing for either
right.
point of view. What I'm saying is this is apocalyptic. The way it was written was intentionally to obscure truth for those who might read it and shouldn't understand it. They would not be able to understand it. It was written for Christians who could understand it. For them to be able to interpret it, there had to be a key in there for them so they could interpret it correctly. That's all I'm getting at.
Okay.
This verse here, I think, is one of those instances where I think it hints at the key.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. All right. Anybody else? Yes, Rick.
Also, at the time, there were still miracles and signs that they'd done, and you had to find knowledge of the revelation that was being given at the time. So when this being read to the Christians, Christians who have that ability to comprehend because the Spirit left them comprehend. It was in that time frame of the word being revealed in heart. So when this letter is being read, we have some to be able to interpret that message.
Okay, I understand. Yeah, I get the gift of interpretation, gift of knowledge God can give by. Okay. All right, so with that in mind, let's just kind of get into some new stuff. And I know I found that as we've gone through this, it's become more and more repetitive in a sense, going through these things. But there are some points that I want to make with each section, so we'll go fairly quickly through this. The second thing that we want to note is why is this seen in the text, the purpose of it. And again, something to consider in Dennis's words is the desire of the writer of the Apocalypse as he reveals these visions, John, is to give knowledge and understanding to the individuals in the first century who would be suffering under these circumstances with regard to actually seeing the beast from the sea and the beast from the earth arise and the persecution that presents it to them and such, and be able to identify and be aware of those. So there are some things, though, that we can apply and learn from this. And I think that in the 13th chapter in its entirety, what you see is a symbiotic relationship between the secular and the religious that existed and has existed, and in fact, throughout history. You know, if you think about it, the American experiment, which is less than 300 years old, is one where individuals who were being persecuted left their lands to come to a place where they could worship God without fear of being molested or oppressed or persecuted by those who are in charge, the secular government in charge. And so in America, you don't have a state church. You do in Canada. The Church of Canada is a state church. The Church of England, the Church of Scotland, the Church of Ireland, those are state churches. And Roman Catholicism, throughout the history of its existence from about the 7th century on, was very closely tied in, sometimes actually even more powerful than secular governments. In other words, the Pope had more power than an emperor or a king or a prime minister or whatever the case may be, and that's kind of vacillated back and forth to where, again, you have secular governments have preeminence in our day. But there is always that tie-in that has been present in religion. It's not just with regard to Christianity. It has been through the ages. Again, when you think about Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire, the Persian Empire that followed, the problems that both Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had, as well as Daniel, who was thrown into the lion's den for a night because he was told you can't pray to your God. You can only serve the God, having reference to the emperor, and Daniel wouldn't do it. And so because he prayed publicly and openly three times a day, then he was thrown into the lion's den as a result of it. So we find all of these kinds of examples throughout the ages. It is the case that often religion and government works together. And often, if not always, when that happens, it is for evil rather than good. I guess the only example that you say where it was for good was in the theology that was established under the Old Covenant, where God ruled over the people, and the good kings, such as David and a few others, then they led the people into righteousness rather than evil. But generally, when you've got religion and the secular world powers that are combining one with another, that oppression of Christians is something that is inevitable. So keep that in mind. The devil works that way. He works both through the secular as well as the religious. And even if we're going to make just general applications in that regard, we see that today. What's most problematic for us as Christians today? I would dare say, though it may change, it's not the secular government or secular culture. That is an influence toward evil, but we have actually in some ways been protected by our secular government because of our lineage as Americans. But false religion for the last 100, 200, 300 years in America, false religion is something that has cost the souls of many as individuals are led astray by whether it be signs and wonders or false doctrines, sophistry that is established that lead people astray. So it's dangerous. You have a combination of the two. Just understand that the devil works through both. I think that it's important for us as we address these things, and we talked about it just a little bit in our last study, is that we address the idea of the performance of the great signs. The reason why is because when you look at, for example, John the 20th chapter, John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, the writer John indicates that the things that he recorded for their reading, for the individuals who read the Gospel of John, as they read those things, he included certain signs that Jesus did to assure them that Jesus was the Son of God. In other words, the signs were intended as proof. When Jesus performed the signs that he performed on earth, whether it was changing the water into wine, whether it was healing the sick, whether it was walking upon the water, those things that Jesus did, raising Lazarus from the dead, were signs that were to establish without any doubt whatsoever that he was from God. No one could do the things that he did unless God had sent him. And so if that's the case, that these signs that were established were without doubt validating that Jesus was who he claimed to be. That he is saying, I'm from God. The Father and I are one. I am the Messiah come into the world. That because he proved himself through the signs, he proved that the claims that he was making for himself are true as well. So we can be assured, just as they could be assured in the first century, that Jesus is indeed the Son of God. That he is the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through or by him. That we are saved through his shed blood and receive the remission of sins for those things. So now we've got a false prophet, a beast from the earth who has the ability to do great signs and wonders. If he has the ability to do great signs and wonders in this particular case, the things that he does were sufficient to deceive individuals into worshiping the beast from the sea. This false prophet or beast from the earth causes them to worship the beast from the sea. So, if that is the case, how do we differentiate between the works that were legitimate that Jesus did that shows he's from God and these lying wonders that were illegitimate, which did not prove that they truly had divine characteristics, but led people to believe that they did? That's kind of a hard question to answer, isn't it? And so there are just a couple of things that I wanted to make note of that are true. I don't know the nature of these lying wonders that are mentioned in this particular text. Notice verse 13. He performs great signs, so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on earth in the sight of men, and deceives those who dwell on the earth by the signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, causing them to worship the beast. Well, you understand that power, supernatural power, and I want to differentiate between divine power and supernatural power. Power that is beyond nature, simply is what I'm saying there, which could be, have its derivation with God or with evil. We find, for example, in the first century, we find that there were demons who possessed men. And we find that that you had Simon in Acts the 8th chapter, who was a sorcerer, who did great signs and convinced the people that he was some great person from God. So all these, but there's a differentiation made there. And so what those signs are, whether it was merely magic acts with no supernatural power at all, or whether there was supernatural power that was present still in this first century, that these lying evil beasts were able to perpetrate a fraud upon mankind, there has to be a distinction, and a distinction that is obvious, between those things and the legitimate acts that Jesus did and that God did, and that the disciples who were given the powers that they were given, Mark 16, that they were given as they went and proclaimed the message. Now, how do we distinguish? I don't know that we necessarily can, but there are a couple of things, or we can come up with a cue, but it was something that became obvious and was obvious to those. And the two examples that I would give to establish this truth, the first one is actually an Old Testament example with regard to the signs that were given to Pharaoh in Exodus chapter 7. And you'll remember in Exodus 7, of course, the 10 plagues. And some of those plagues, or aspects of those plagues, you'll remember the sorcerers of Pharaoh was able to replicate. Give me an example in Exodus chapter 7 and verse 8. Going down to verse 13, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "When Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, 'Show a miracle for yourselves.'" In other words, Pharaoh saying, "I want proof. You're saying that we have to let you go, and God says we have to let you go. Give me proof." Pharaoh wants a sign. He wants a miracle. So this is what you do. You tell Aaron, "Take your rod, cast it before Pharaoh, and let it become a serpent." So that's what Aaron did. So Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh, before his servants, and that rod became a serpent. That's a sign right there. And that sign was from God. But we are told in verse 11 that Pharaoh called the wise men and sorcerers, the magicians of Egypt, and they also did in like manner with their enchantments. For every man threw down his rod, and they became serpents. So they were able to do what Aaron did. How did they do it? Was it sleight of hand? It says specifically enchantments that were available to them at that time that they were able to accomplish it. Point is, there was a difference between what God did and what they did. And it is seen in this fact, in verse 12, after their rods became serpents, Aaron's rod swallowed up their rods. And that was a sign that the work that God had wrought there was greater than the works that they could do. And of course, it became more and more evident as the plagues were added one upon another. Pharaoh's heart was hardened in the beginning. He would not believe, but eventually... And finally, with the death of the firstborn, it became obvious that Jehovah God is a great God. And he said, "Get out of here." And he later changed his mind and chased them, I know. But it took all of that to go. Okay, so let me give you one other example. I want you to notice, and I think we made an allusion to this last time. So let me see if I... Yeah, go to Acts chapter 8 with regard to Simon. The only thing I want to note with regard to Simon the sorcerer in this particular text, as they previously were told in verse 9, practiced sorcery in the city. He astonished the people of Samaria. Now, what kind of sorcery? Well, you know as well as I do that when you see magicians work, magicians with their sleight of hand, magicians with their illusions and such, they are absolutely amazing. And it looks like real magic, what they're able to do. When you get it explained later as to how they did it, it's just as amazing because of the dexterity that it takes and the imagination it takes to pull it off. But then you see, okay, that's just a trick. I don't know if what Simon was doing was a trick or not, or if he had some powers at that time. Again, demons walked upon the earth here in the first century, and there may have been some magical power that Simon had. But he claimed, notice verse 9, he claimed that he was someone great. And all of them gave heed to him, from the least to the greatest, saying, this man is the great power of God. So whatever it was that he was able to accomplish and do was so convincing to the people. He said, look at me. Look at what I can do. And they said, this man's from God. Now again, that's what Jesus did. In as we seek to parallel these points, so I can make my point. Jesus went about doing great works and said, I'm from God. Now what's the difference between the two? Well, I want you to note in verse 11, we're told they heeded him because he had astonished them with his sorceries for a long time. But when they believed Philip, as he preached the things concerning the kingdom of God and the name of Jesus Christ, both men and women are baptized. And Simon himself also believed. When he was baptized, he continued with Philip, and he was amazed seeing the miracles and signs which were done. So all I can tell you in regard to this particular context is whatever it was that Simon was doing, Philip came with the divine power of God, and the miracles that Philip performed convinced the people that Philip was the genuine deal with regard to what he was preaching, and convinced Simon, who was the great sorcerer, who used his enchantments to practice this sorcery, it proved to him that what I've got is not legitimate. What is legitimate is what Philip has. So much so that later on he sinned because he wanted the ability to do what the apostles were able to do and lay hands on people that they might receive those powers. So there's a distinction. What that distinction is, I don't know. But the point being is that whatever it was that was being done by this false prophet here in Acts 13 and verse 11 and following, or being done by this false religion, these works that were being accomplished, those things were not legitimate, and they were not up to the divine standard. And again, when you take that number, they were less than perfect or less than divine in that regard. And it was something that would be evident to those who were discerning, those who were willing with an open mind to examine those things. So what is that lesson for us? Well, you know, the purpose of that is for us to acknowledge a couple things. We've already had established that what Jesus did was divine. We have established for ourselves the truth of the gospel, the word of God, that covenant established by the Lord, that New Testament, has been confirmed by the miracles and signs that were done. This is true. We know for a fact it is true, and we know for a fact it is divine. When someone comes along today and says, watch this, boom, and does something that seems to be amazing, seems to be supernatural, and so maybe then it must be divine, but they're teaching something that is different than that which is found in this book. It's not. It's not legitimate at all. It's counterfeit. You know, a lot of people today who claim to be miracle workers, and they have abilities to confuse people and to lead people to believe what it is they're saying. But what they're teaching differs from what is revealed in God's word. And so they're false teachers. And if they're false teachers, what it is that they're doing today is not divine. I would posit as well, it's not supernatural either, but I'm just making that point that we have to be discerning. And if we're discerning, we can differentiate, just as Simon did, just as the Samaritans did, we can differentiate between what is legitimately from God and what is not. Now that's preaching instead of teaching the class, but I do that sometimes. So anybody want to add anything to that or any comments? Yes, Dennis.
Not to look at it, just to advertise it, 2 Thessalonians 2 talks about all of this.
Yeah, same thing. In fact, I've got that that passage that I'm going to bring up and bring to mind a little bit later, perhaps next week. We'll talk about that a little bit. Anybody else? Yes,
Rick.
There's also an instance of sorcery where Saul approached a medium trying to get Samuel, who was dead, and he came back in a spirit form to talk to Saul.
Yeah.
And there was amazement there, but that was looked at the script and him to do.
Yeah.
But it was something that was available at that time.
Yeah, and something to keep in mind as well. Again, you know, When we talk today about the idea of miracles and the age of miracles has come to an end because the word has been confirmed, look at what Paul wrote on it in 1 Corinthians 13 and such. So we recognize that we're in these last days perhaps in a slightly different situation than in the first century where these demons were possessing men and such, and that the power of Satan has been negated or limited in those ways. It doesn't change the fact that there is evil that is out there, and we ought not to be participating in it. And one of the things that comes to mind with regard to the lust of the flesh, the beginning of Galatians chapter 5, is that the word sorcery is used in that, which has reference to an actual Greek word which involves the idea of drug use, the pharma something. But from where we get pharmacy or pharmacology and such, it's the Greek word. And it's referenced sorcery. And so there were enchantments, there were hallucinogens, there were other things that were used and are used in the first century. But recognize that it's not only saying in that text that we're not to use drugs, but that drugs are often used in the practice of evil. That which is, if not overtly satanic, then at least contrary to the worship of the one true God. It's the forces of darkness rather than the forces of evil, and we're not to have anything to do with those kinds of things. So I do want to make note of that. But again, in this first century, this was a very convincing situation where the world was taken in by them because of what they could accomplish, what they could do. But the discerning individual, the one who had wisdom, the one who had patience and who had faith, was one who could withstand and not be caught up by those and stay on the side of God rather than on the side of men. Okay? Appreciate very much everyone's kind of attention. Again, we've gone a little slow for a couple of weeks on this. We'll try to pick up and get through most of it. I don't think we can get through all of it, but through most of it in our study next Sunday. Appreciate very much everyone's kind of attention today. And we'll pick up again with the same section in our study next week.